From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're learning more about the 19-year-old who allegedly used a legally purchased AR-15 rifle in that horrific shooting yesterday at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. The suspect, Nicholas Cruz, is in police custody, appears in court today. He reportedly had undergone mental health treatments and left a trail of disturbing social media posts. Governor Rick Scott spoke at a press conference earlier today.
How do we make sure when a parent is ready to send their child to school that in Florida that parent knows that child is going to be safe? Number two, how do we make sure that individuals with mental illness do not touch a gun?
Joey Fletchos is a reporter at the Miami Herald. He joins us from their newsroom. Hi, Joey.
Hi.
Look, we know that Cruz had been expelled from that school. The Washington Post is reporting that teachers got a note last year from the administration asking them to keep an eye on him. The teacher said it was alarming. So what is the process of buying a gun in Florida? What is Scott referring to? Do we know when Cruz purchased this gun, and were there questions that weren't asked?
Well, the question of whether there were questions that weren't asked, there certainly weren't, and procedurally there are what some people would consider a lack of questioning that's involved with the purchase of a gun. I mean, even the mere fact what's being called into question now is the mere fact that he wouldn't be able to, at his age, 19, that he wouldn't have been able to buy a handgun, but he could purchase the .223 caliber rifle that he used from a gun shop in Broward County in February of 2017. He cleared an FBI background check. He did not have a criminal history, but what's quickly emerging now is a debate and a conversation about what kinds of questions can be asked and should be asked when someone in his position is wanting to purchase a firearm.
And we're not clear as to what that position is, when he was treated for these mental health issues. I mean, a lot of that is, you know, not known, you know, the timing. So that'll be interesting to see all that unfold. But meanwhile, his online life, you're reporting that a man in Mississippi called Facebook and the FBI after someone calling themselves Nicholas Cruz posted a threatening comment on YouTube in 2017. What do we know about that?
Correct. A man who is a bail bondsman, and he regularly posts YouTube videos on his page. He noticed a comment in September of 2017. And a user named Nicholas Cruz, spelled the same way as the suspected shooter, said, "I'm going to be a professional school shooter." And he immediately reported it. He actually screenshot and emailed it to his local FBI field office. Agents were in his business interviewing him the next day. And he really didn't have any reaction or knowledge of who this person was. He just simply wanted to pass along that this comment had been made. And interestingly, this morning, the local South Florida FBI special agent in charge told reporters that even after they took that tip seriously back in September, but after reviews and checks, they could not identify the user who was behind the comment.
Even if the user was using the name Nicholas Cruz. So it seems as if there's going to be questions there for Facebook and, you know, how to get to people online. Look, what more do we know about him? Expelled from that school where he went back and had the horrific shooting, currently attending a school for at-risk youth. His mother apparently just died in November.
That's correct. Our understanding is she may have had some sort of respiratory issue, a flu. There are some different reports out there. I'm not completely sure what caused her death, but she did pass away recently, and he was living with a family friend. He had his own room. But, you know, there are indications that perhaps that could have affected his mental health. We don't have a complete picture of his mental health, but we do know after talking to neighbors in the last place that he was living, that he had a reputation for being a loner, for being isolated, for being a little violent with animals, something we've learned today. After speaking to neighbors, he had at one point someone had seen him shooting at neighbors' chickens with a BB gun or a pellet gun, shooting at squirrels, poking a rabbit hole with a stick. And setting his family's dog on a neighbor's piglets. It was a couple of different anecdotes we've collected from neighbors about his interaction with small animals, which seemed to suggest that they're, you know, he might have been troubled in some way.
Well, I mean, mental health professionals will say that when a child is abusing animals, that is a real alarming sign of something.
That's a sign, right.
Joey Fletchos of the Miami Herald with more on what people are learning about the alleged shooter in yesterday's massacre in Florida. Joey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
President Trump ordered all flags at U.S. federal buildings to be flown at half staff, and he addressed the nation calling for safer schools.
We are committed to working with state and local leaders to help secure our schools and tackle the difficult issue of mental health. Later this month, I will be meeting with the nation's governors and attorney generals. We're making our schools and our children safer will be our top priority. It is not enough to simply take actions that make us feel like we are making a difference. We must actually make that difference.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And Ron, notably, Trump said nothing in his address about guns.
He did not, although Governor Scott in Florida, who is a Trump ally and a conservative Republican, did mention the word gun. He said that they wanted to keep people who have mental health problems from getting guns or getting their hands on a gun. That even was not mentioned by the president. We know from previous experience that after a mass shooting, the first response from officials in charge and in power is usually to say, this isn't the best time to talk about this. We really shouldn't talk about it out of respect for the victims. Then the next thing we hear is that we're going to talk about it, but we're going to enforce the laws that we have and that the real problem is mental health.
Although yesterday there was a tweet from someone who said, well, is now the time to talk about guns post the Las Vegas shooting, now that enough time has passed since that one. This was the second time in 2 days in which Trump was under pressure to speak because he didn't speak about this shooting yesterday. And yesterday he did talk finally about domestic violence. Here's some of what he said.
I am totally opposed to domestic violence of any kind. Everyone knows that. And it almost wouldn't even have to be said.
The White House has been struggling for more than a week to clarify how aides, including Chief of Staff John Kelly, dealt with former Staff Secretary Rob Porter amid domestic violence allegations. What's notable about what Trump finally said there?
Well, Trump is still trying to tell us that he is against domestic violence. That seems to be the first hurdle for him to get over. Then the next thing would be to acknowledge that there was some knowledge somewhere in the White House about the problems that Rob Porter had been accused of. And this has not really been acknowledged, even though the FBI director has said that they submitted a report, a preliminary report, on Rob Porter all the way back in March, and then another report in July, and that they had completely finished their research, and they have not shared all that research with us, but they did say they had shared it all with the White House. So that question is still out there. We have the security clearance question. We have the what is the attitude of the White House towards a key member of the staff who has these allegations against him.
John Kelly's predecessor, former Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, gave an interview in which he says he takes you can take all the reports of chaos in the White House and dysfunction and multiply it times 50. He also talked about having to talk Attorney General Jeff Sessions out of resigning after his recusal from the Russia investigation. What do you make of this latest interview?
This is going to be a little bit difficult to assign to this same disbelief that the book by Michael Wolff, the book that came out earlier this year and that the president, yes, has denounced so many times. It's going to be hard to apply that same sort of arm's length pushback to a book by the chief of staff, Reince Priebus, who has not only been the president's chief of staff, but was previously the chairman of the Republican National Committee and has been in recent months, even after leaving the White House, quite silent and quite respectful and has not had a lot of critical things to say about the president.
Ron, on Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of senators is floating what they say is a passable compromise on immigration as they try to pass something for a self-imposed deadline this week. It includes eventual funding for a wall and eventual citizenship for young immigrants brought here illegally as children, but not their parents. The Trump administration is already saying they're opposed to it. What do you see happening here?
The president has not only said he's opposed to it and signaled his allies in the Senate to vote against it, but he has also said he would veto it if passed by the Senate and then by the House, which means, of course, it would have very little chance in the Senate and zero chance in the House if the president is not in support of it. So he has torpedoed, at this point, the bipartisan plan that was put together by some Democrats, most of the Democrats, and Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, and Mike Rounds, another Republican in the Senate, and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, another Republican in the Senate. So the closest thing we have had to a bipartisan deal in the Senate on immigration is being shot down at this very hour by the White House.
It's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving on a lot of stories happening in Washington today. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, the Olympics are underway, and some of those elite athletes are no doubt familiar with hypoxic training. That's breathing in low oxygenated air, the kind you'd find at high altitudes. Athletes do it to increase red blood cells and performance. Climbers say it shortens the time they need to acclimate to higher altitudes. So how does it work? Well, we're about to find out in a workout room at Hypoxico, a New York-based company, where alpinist David Roski steps onto a treadmill and gets ready to pull on a mask with a long hose connected to an oxygen generator.
Let's go straight to 12. That way we'll get a really pronounced effect. You'll see how very quickly I'm going pretty deeply hypoxic. So why don't we get on here?
By 12, David means the generator will deliver him the same air he'd find at 12,000 feet. Thin, low oxygen, hard to breathe. On his finger, he wears a pulse oximeter, which measures his oxygen saturation. And at the start, it's normal, 99%, because in New York, at sea level, he's getting all the oxygen his body needs. David also has a personal Hypoxico mask and generator at home, along with a Hypoxico tent and generator. Now, they run about $3,000 to $4,000, and he sleeps in the tent at night when he's training for a climb. Hypoxico's Stan Pillman and Brian Bilius explain.
You know, if I'm at sea level in New York, I'm sleeping in a Hypoxico tent, and I sleep at 8,000, 9,000 feet every night, and then maybe I get on a treadmill for 20 minutes and do, you know, high-powered repeat sprint performances.
So using the mask.
Using the mask.
So how many people are sleeping in tents that have a lower level of oxygen than the rest of their surroundings?
We have a lot of units out there. I mean, like, what, is it 10,000? I always get
there. There's thousands and thousands of units out.
So all over the world, there are people who are in a tent in their bedroom sleeping at high altitude, even if they're not at high altitude.
Yes. Oh, yes. You know, mountain climbers, Olympic athletes, elite athletes. 2 seconds, a second can be the difference between meddling and not meddling. Then we found as studies grow and, you know, from Harvard to Emory University, our equipment is in there to perform studies on wellness, asthmatic patients, allergenics.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, as you start listing all the things that this little tent can do, you know, people are, you know, it's a miracle. And right. That it makes people skeptical that it feels like snake oil. There's an Olympic physician who said, there's just no way you can get that much red blood cells in a couple of hours.
Right. It takes 4 to 6 weeks of sleeping to truly have a physiological change.
Which brings us back to David Roski on the treadmill, his face mask tethered to the oxygen generator.
I don't know if you guys can really understand me, but...
How do you feel?
I feel fine right now.
But as he takes in the low oxygen air, his blood oxygen level is dropping from 99% saturation to the 80s. It's getting harder to breathe.
And if a paramedic picked me up in the 80s or 70s, they would be very scared. Let's see if we can get into the 70s.
Definitely not a recommended. We wouldn't do this with someone who's never used our equipment. David is an expert alpinist.
Well, but do you ever worry that you might get addicted to this? Like, hey, let's see if we can go here. You couldn't stop.
Good question.
Well, there is an addiction to the high altitude experience. If you're a rational person, you balance that with the risk. And the risks are significant, so I want to live a long time. Now I'm breathing very hard.
Okay, you were just down at 73, 75. Are we okay here?
I think we've proved our point.
So now that I took this off, let's watch how quickly my blood oxygen saturation comes back up.
To 81. By the way, how do you feel?
You know, when you come out, it's always just like, oh, oxygen, it's wonderful. And you can feel a little loopy for a little bit. That's why medical professionals would never recommend going as low as I did right there. And that's why Hypoxico doesn't recommend people take it that quickly. But in my regular training, catching my breath, I also take a gradual ramp up as well.
But does it work? Well, elite athletes who, like David Roski, are clients of Hypoxico, think it does. Again, here's Brian Bilyeus and Stan Pillman.
Yeah, and then we just have also the clients that are out of town that if they're visiting, they'll come by and actually do a workout in the chamber. And
just to get a hit of high altitude.
Exactly, while they're away from home.
Michael Phelps was on 60 Minutes talking about how when he would wake up in the morning and open up the tent, and you know, you get hit with this huge, you know, burst of sea level air, you're just up and ready to go.
There's a couple hockey players we have out there that are with the Chicago Blackhawks. We have the Oakland Raiders. We have the U.S. men's soccer team. They have it now at a facility of theirs.
So LeBron James and Dwayne Wade have used the equipment. Kilian Jornet, who's one of the most, you know, well-known, famous alpinists, just went through the most insane acclimatization process to climb Everest. David, who's sitting here.
I love getting hypoxic, like low oxygen, anytime I can. By day, I am an analyst for an investment fund, picking stocks, and everything outside of work, I'm into big mountains and getting as high as I possibly can in altitude.
So when did you start using this equipment?
So I first got it, oh man, it must have been 6 or 7 years ago. In my apartment building, I have a treadmill, so I can just lug the generator down the hall, go to the gym and wear the mask and just hike at a slow pace, but get myself extremely hypoxic from that. I grew up in Loveland, Colorado, near Denver's altitude, about 5,000 feet. And I would go back home to try to run 5Ks there. And I was always about a minute slower. I first got interested in the altitude tent and bought one to try to be pre-acclimated to run races back home. But then after that, I got interested in high altitude mountaineering and ended up using the tent to prepare for climbing Mount Everest 2 different times.
Did it work?
I had huge benefit from it. So most people spend about 7 weeks, sometimes 8 weeks on the whole trip, basically hiking up from base camp, which is already 18,000 feet, maybe to camp one or camp two, and coming back down. They do that multiple times to get acclimated. The worst cases of altitude sickness can result in high altitude cerebral edema, high altitude pulmonary edema. If you are acclimated, you know, a few people can make it up as high as the top of Everest without oxygen, which until Reinhold Messner first did that, doctors didn't think it was even humanly possible.
So here's people normally taking 7-8 weeks to get that acclimation. Right. How long did it take you?
So I arrived at base camp on May 3rd in 2013, and I summited 19 days later. And a big part of that is with my day job, I just couldn't ask for 2 months off.
Yeah, but most people, they wouldn't. You were that acclimated when you got there.
I slept in the tent from March 17 through about April 20. So
here in New York.
Here in New York. And I would see, okay, what was my blood oxygen saturation? And then as my blood oxygen saturation started to creep up, then I would turn up the generator and go to a higher altitude. And by the end, I was actually sleeping at around 17,000 foot simulated altitude. The same amount of oxygen was available to me in the tent as I would have there at base camp. And then I flew over to Nepal and I did this very accelerated climb of it. I would just rest a couple days at a camp and then go up to another camp, rest a few more days. And that enabled me to do a super accelerated trip.
Did you use oxygen?
My real goal originally was to do it without oxygen. So a couple years later in 2016, I climbed 2 8,000 meter peaks, Cho Oyu first, which is the sixth highest mountain, and then took a jeep ride over to Everest Base Camp and climbed Everest also without oxygen about 2 weeks later.
We're all laughing. We are all laughing. Everyone here is laughing because this is insane. You know what the questions are. There are people who say, well, wait a second, isn't the objective when you climb something like Everest to spend those weeks acclimating, to have that full experience that everybody has? You're smiling.
So,
is that cheating what you did? Part of something that's changing the experience forever so that it won't be the challenge that it was.
It's extremely challenging no matter how you do it. But training with an oxygen, like a hypoxic tent beforehand, can help you as one part of a very arduous training process. Yeah. You can be there enjoying the experience a little bit more, I think, because you have a bigger margin of safety. But I think the biggest feeling that I had there was just utter gratitude. The weird idea that there's no place on earth that you can step higher.
Okay, where is she?
Where is she at right now? We're at about 11,000 feet.
Now, I was on crutches during that visit, long story, but producer Karen Miller-Medson, a marathoner who's run at altitude, gamely slipped on the mask, not for long.
I'm really feeling it. Just that little burst of running.
You're down at 77.
Okay, I'm going to take it off.
Yeah.
And now the mask is off.
What are you feeling?
Oh, taking it off? My lungs just inflated with oxygen. It's day and night. Wow. That's just from a walk.
Yeah, now it's back up to 93. Wow, that was fast. Those are the sounds of our colleague Karen, hypoxic training at Manhattan's Hypoxico, where we spoke with alpinist David Roski, who credits his 19-day summit of Mount Everest without oxygen in part to his hypoxic training. We'll have pictures and David's video from the top of Everest at herenow.org, where we'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Have you tried it? Do you think it's cheating? Discuss.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we'll, of course, continue to bring you any news out of Florida regarding yesterday's terrifying school shooting. Of course, victims and survivors and their families top of mind. But it's also interesting to look at what happens in the gun industry. Stock in a number of gun companies rose yesterday afternoon during the news coverage of the shooting. But earlier this week, the 200-year-old Remington Outdoor Company announced a bankruptcy filing. They're looking to restructure to get rid of debt. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So the American Outdoor Brands, formerly Smith & Wesson Holding, and Ruger Firearms Companies both saw these share prices rise before falling today. Now, this is common after a mass shooting. Remind us, what are investors thinking when they rush to buy stocks?
It's sobering. It's wash, rinse, repeat, and you have an increasingly large sample size if you go back over 20 years, tragically. You know, it's common after both mass shootings, that knee-jerk fear of Washington curtailing assault weapons. So, you know, buy them while you can. And also, especially after Democrats win. You can go back to the day after Obama was reelected in 2012, and it was one of the best days on record for gun stocks.
Well, so investors are thinking people are going to rush and buy these guns because they think they think there are going to be restrictions. But there is an irony here this time because, well, we mentioned Remington Outdoor. This is the company that bills itself as America's oldest gun maker. It's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They're going to continue operating as they do a restructuring deal. But the irony is, well, what's behind their bankruptcy, Robin?
Well, look, it's a storied company. It's been there for more than 200 years, but it's also one of those too much debt stories, which is a bit more mundane. The private equity giant that bought it and ran afoul of investors after the 2012 Sandy Hook elementary school massacre, you know, it was forced by investors to explore options. It couldn't sell it, and now it can't service the debt payments because you have such a glut of firearms in the United States. I mean, overall, the sector manufactured more than 11 million guns in 2016. I mean, perhaps expecting Hillary Clinton would win, but you compare that to less than 4 million guns a year a decade ago.
Well, and part of the irony that Bloomberg.com and some others are pointing out is that Remington could be having some problems because there is a president in the White House who's very friendly towards guns and gun manufacturers. Today, President Trump didn't even mention guns in talking about the shooting. And that because there might be a sense that it's a president who's friendly to guns and not friendly to gun restrictions, people aren't rushing out to buy them.
Yeah, and you know they've stuffed the channel a lot. I mean, you can only talk about this in so many different cold-eyed ways, but how many iPhones can a person own
right.
at one time? You have right. a class of super hoarders of semi-automatics.
Is that why perhaps in the minute we have, we got news last week from the FBI that January gun sales were down over last year?
Yeah, we are awash in guns. I can't underscore it enough. The U.S. has, what, less than 5% of the planet's population, but get this, 42% of its civilian-owned guns. You know, another way of looking at this, half of the firearms in the U.S. are hoarded by 3% of the adult population. And you're also having a thriving, kind of lightly regulated market for used guns. You can go out and buy guns that were bought new a long time ago without many people breathing down your neck. And that, on balance, is not good for gun manufacturers.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Again, the most important aspect of this story yesterday is the victims. But it's really interesting to look at the gun industry. Robin, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The Winter Olympics continue today in South Korea, and while there's been a lot of focus on the medals, there's also the underlying tension between the U.S. and North Korea. In fact, the Olympics have long been at the center of political disputes, and for a look back at that, we're joined by Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back, and Nathan, let me start with you. The first modern Olympics happened in Athens, Greece in 1896. What was the intent of the Games back then?
Well, the idea about the Olympics, of course, is one of friendly competition between modern nations. When you have games in Athens in 1896, Paris in 1900, really through the early part of the 20th century, the idea is that you're going to create a space where people can demonstrate their nations as modern, progressive, and capable. But like anything that has those kinds of values wrapped up in it, other more insidious things can sometimes creep in. Ideas about civilization and hierarchy, even eugenics, obviously geopolitics. And so there's a sense in which, you know, the idea of an Olympic Games that's somehow disconnected from the political questions of superiority and national superiority, those ideas don't really exist in separate forms in the early period.
Well, and let's talk about 1936. This was when the Summer Olympics were held in Berlin, Germany. The leader of Germany at that time was Adolf Hitler. How did the politics play out at those games?
Well, the funny thing about the Germany games, we have a way of looking back on them now as this moment where Hitler was trying to very, you know, specifically and intentionally, you know, claim the games as a moment to assert German superiority. But it did not begin that way. In fact, the International Olympic Committee conferred Germany with the ability to have the games in 1931 as a way to welcome Germany back into the international community. And the Nazi Party didn't come into power until 1933. And so Hitler just kind of, you know, basically wandered into the response responsibility of having to house the games. And they weren't that interested, the Nazi Party, in doing much with it. They saw it as a forum that was dominated by an international Jewish conspiracy, no surprise. And it really wasn't until Hitler began to inspect the facilities in and around Berlin that he realized that this is an opportunity. Now, it's important to note that Germany did, in fact, win more medals that year than any other country, even though we look back now at the performance of Jesse Owens and his 4 gold medals, that this was still, you know, by all accounts, a success for the German nation state in 1936.
And Jesse Owens, by the way, an African-American track athlete. What kind of reception did he get in the United States?
Well, the thing about Jesse Owens is, you know, he has a very positive experience in Germany from his own recollection. He actually says that I was treated worse in the United States than I was in Germany. They featured him in films about the games, which, you know, obviously wasn't common for African-American athletes to be featured prominently in the 1930s. And there was actually a sense that newspapers were using Owens' own success, sometimes basically dishonestly. So you have, for instance, the New York Times, which runs a headline that says Hitler ignores Negro medalists, claiming that it's about Jesse Owens, when in fact it was about another guy by the name of Cornelius Johnson, who just happened to be high jumping when the stadium was near empty and Hitler wasn't even around. And so the image of Jesse Owens as a winner becomes useful from a propaganda standpoint for the United States. But again, his experience was not one where he felt particularly maligned or marginalized in Germany during his time there.
Now, in 1948, Germany was not invited to the London Olympics right after the war. Let's jump forward 2 decades to 1968, which was a year of unrest in the U.S. and around the world, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And at the Games, there were Tommy Smith and John Carlos. What happened there?
Well, you're referring to the famous ceremony awards when those two American athletes mounted the podium and gave a gloved-fisted Black Power salute. And they did that in solidarity with African Americans in the United States and around the world.
Right.
And of course, Jeremy, this was a time when protesters were protesting against something called the establishment. And the very idea of a politics-free Olympics was really coming under assault. All these millions of dollars being poured in by nation states. That was political, too.
We have to talk about 1972, which was meant to represent peace in Munich, but it turned out to be marred by violence.
The 72 games can't be disconnected from the 36 games. They're the next time that the games are being held in Germany. By this point, people have looked back on the atrocities of, you know, Germany during World War II, and it's an effort for the International Olympic Committee and the authorities in Germany to really rebrand the country yet again. I mean, it's funny how much weight we expect the Olympic Games to carry for these host nations. They called them the Cheerful Games in 1972. Mm-hmm. It was the first Olympics that had a mascot, a dachshund named Waldy, right? Meant to, you know, convey a certain kind of cuteness and really be disarming. But as you know, we now know, of course, the 72 games were marred with just 5 days left to go with a terrorist attack by a Palestinian secular nationalist group called Black September. They kidnapped and ultimately killed 11 Israeli athletes, coaches, even a West German police officer was killed in the fracas.
Israel, mourning its dead and angered at the killers, prepares to hold a state funeral tomorrow for the 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany. The Olympic Games are resumed after memorial services attended by 80,000 persons are held in Munich.
And you have a gentleman who is running the International Olympic Committee, a man by the name of Avery Brundage, who basically is forced to say, even after this event, that the games must go on, right? The games are not halted. Mm. You know, it's seen as being something that has to keep chugging along because of the overall global importance of showing that the games, again, transcend politics. And so, you know, it's also, I think, important to bear in mind that what happens because of the platform being so high with the actions of Black September is that the world really does kick into a kind of anti-terrorist position. And you have the United States, for instance, basically create a program called Operation Boulder that really is the first time that the U.S. starts surveilling Arab ethnics in the United States. They have a massive visa program that really is targeting people trying to come into the United States. But it also was largely ineffective. I mean, they kept out very few people from coming to the U.S. and the program was discontinued after just a couple years. But Munich kept coming back as a kind of chant about what was at stake if you didn't show a certain certain kind of vigilance on the terrorist question on the world stage.
Now, this year, the Olympics are happening in South Korea, which is kind of interesting given the situation going on between North Korea and South Korea and the United mm-hmm. States. In 1980, the Games, and this was during the Cold War, the Games were in Moscow and the U.S. boycotted.
That's right. And before they were in Moscow, they were in Lake Placid for the Winter Olympics, if we're going to compare winter to winter. And that was the miracle on ice, Jeremy. And that became a huge moment in geopolitical pride building, if you will. The situation in the United States was one of American hostages being held. It was the end of the Jimmy Carter administration. There was a lot of tension between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan shortly before those Winter Olympics. And there was a general sense of malaise and decline in the United States. And this ragtag team of college hockey players basically beat the big red machine. The Soviets had won the gold medal, I don't know, the last three or four times. It was kind of theirs to lose. Nobody gave the Americans a chance. Yet they proceeded through those hockey games, and they beat the mighty Soviet Union. And as you might guess, politicians, starting with Jimmy Carter, but then Ronald Reagan when he was running for president and president, he just jumped on the bandwagon. This was a sign of American pride resurfacing, American strength resurfacing mm-hmm. in this geopolitical struggle.
You're saying Soviet Union. I guess now we would call them Olympic athletes from the Soviet Union.
Formerly of the United Team in 1992, right?
Yes, unified team. Right. And there was, you know, the contrast between how the American team was aggregated, basically these college kids, mainly from Minnesota and Boston, how they were aggregated compared to the Soviet team that was very, very much like a professional team. This was used to compare the American way of life to the Soviet way of life. There was a lot more than hockey involved, even though most people wouldn't know the difference between the blue line in hockey and a clothesline. That was one of the announcers say. But.
That's Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today's a big day for comic book and superhero fans. Marvel's movie Black Panther is starting its run in theaters. The trailer's been promising action. Early reviews call it exhilarating and groundbreaking, with a black superhero front and center. The Texas Standard's Laura Rice reports from Austin.
At Dragon's Lair Comics on the north side of Austin, close to 100 people gather on the Saturday evening before the Black Panther film's debut. It's a diverse crowd, but manager Greg Burrow says that's not unusual.
Not at all. We always have a very diverse crowd. That's one of the things about Dragon's Lair is that we try to make this a very comfortable place for everyone.
Robin Johnson is a personal trainer and avid comic book fan, and tonight he's Black Panther.
I'm typically Superman or Batman, but with having something that a little kid can actually relate to, the young African-American kid will be like, well, I can't be this person because I'm not this or I'm not that. It's kind of nice to see a superhero character that, one, I look like, on the screen being portrayed as not a sideshow.
The kids here are taking notice. 11-year-old Isis White says she and her little brother have grown up with comics. They know a lot about Superman and Batman, but Black Panther?
I don't know. I don't know that much about Black Panther because I'm still kind of introduced to him. All I know is that he's going to be a black person in the movie.
Is that a big deal to you?
Yes, because it's Black History Month.
And to many, it feels there is something historic about all the attention coming now to a black character that's been around since the 1960s. Black Panther is hardly the only black superhero, but comic writer Evan Narcisse says he stands out.
The mode of black superheroes for a long time was very shallow. So there was a lot of jive, there was a lot of high temperature kind of characterizations that didn't necessarily round out these characters as full human beings.
Narciss says Black Panther is different, a king named T'Challa, a leader with empathy and a heart for justice, not vengeance. And Narciss would know. He's adding to Black Panther's story, penning 6 new Marvel comic books to go along with the film's release, following in the footsteps of writers he's long admired.
The idea that, in a way, I want to honor my ancestors in the same way that T'Challa does in the comic book, that's a powerful one for me. And it's one I have to compartmentalize.
Because of the weight of that responsibility to the history of this character and the future of what Black Panther represents.
It's a moment. This is something that's going to pull in people who are not, who have not been comic book fans ever.
People like Ranair Dixon, who came to the Austin comic book store event with his kids.
This is our first time coming to an event like this, so we are very super excited. You know, I think we've been dreaming about it and just super excited about it and just cannot wait.
They already have their tickets, and they're excited not just to see Black Panther or T'Challa himself on the big screen, but his homeland, Wakanda. It's a highly advanced civilization on the African continent, with resources and technology not found anywhere else. Never conquered, never colonized.
For me, it's just really mind-blowing, just thinking about the possibilities of something like that existing.
Across the room, comic book sketch artist Tracy Watkins recognizes the importance of all this and agrees the diversity presented in Black Panther is long overdue. But he has a slightly different perspective.
You got a black director and you have a predominantly black cast. That's all great, and I applaud that. But at the end of the day, I want that to fade away and become... That's my favorite superhero. That's my favorite character. And not looking at a color thing.
But event organizer Jasmine Willis says right now that color thing does matter, at least so far in that she wants her kids to see superheroes that look like them, and not just Black Panther. She points to the character on her sweatshirt.
Now, this is not Wonder Woman. This is Nubia. She has dreadlocks. She has the full Wonder Woman getup. She does have the Lasso of Truth, but her weapon of choice is a spear. Nubia is very true to her African roots.
Willis is doubtful Nubia will get her Black Panther moment anytime soon. There's just not enough information about her character, but she's got some hope.
They look like me, and they're doing something really awesome, and our babies need to be reminded of that.
For Here and Now, I'm Laura Rice in Austin.
This note about our top story, the shooting rampage in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 high school students and staff dead. The alleged shooter had reportedly been treated for mental illness and left disturbing social media posts. Today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said he wants the Justice Department to study how mental illness affects criminal behavior. Republican Governor Rick Scott says he's already told Florida's House Speaker that if someone is mentally ill, he should not have access to a gun. Broward County School Superintendent Rob Runcie said now is the time to have a real conversation about gun control legislation. And Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel called for giving police more power to detain people who make graphic threats or post disturbing material online, to even be able to bring them involuntarily to mental health professionals to be examined. We'll follow these threads all day on NPR. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.